there's never a right time to have a baby, but try not to have your first one after 35 because it may be more difficult at that time.
Good day. Welcome to Ripples, Physicians Wellbeing, a space to discuss coping with stressors while training in the field of medicine and tips for overall wellness.
Learn more about the wellness home services at gmewellness.utesca.edu. And don't forget to subscribe to stay updated with new episodes, wherever you enjoy podcasts.
We have Dr. Winifred Mack with us today. She's a board-certified endocrinologist, a reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist on the faculty of UT Long School of Medicine and also Dell School of Medicine, right?
Yep, that's right. Thank you, Veena, and you can call me Winnie, and I'll be glad to give you answers if I can today.
Great, welcome.
So family planning is, you know, is such an important thing, and many residents worry about their fertility window is going to be closing and they're worrying about their biological clock is ticking. And please educate us on that. Are there any truth to it? What is your experience with working with residents?
Sure. So definitely, you know, residents, any sort of educated woman always worries about that. And I think sort of in general, this is how I counsel women, patients, is that fertility does start to decrease at age 35. So that is a true fact. So I think the key is there's never a right time to have a baby, but try not to have your first one after 35 because it may be more difficult at that time.
So thanks for that, Winnie. And it's good to have like a hard and fast number that people can at least think about. Do you see any connection between stress and fertility? Because, of course, all of our residents and fellows are constantly under stress. As physicians, it's kind of what we do. So do you see a connection between those two, stress and fertility?
That's a great question, and actually a subject close to my heart, because I did a project with one of our OBGYN residents a few years back, and I was intrigued about kind of the a lot of female physicians were coming to see me, and they seemed to have very low ovarian reserve or low quantity of eggs for their age. And so I was looking in the primary literature, and there are some mouse studies that show that if a mouse is exposed to chronic stress, that can decrease the number of oocytes that those mice have. In women, it hasn't really been studied. So AMH, or anti-Müllerian hormone, is a marker for ovarian reserve, and it has been studied in infertility patients. And there was one study where they looked at salivary amylase to get a sense of stress levels in these infertility women, and they did notice that women who had increased stress via increased salivary amylase did have decreased quantity of AMH. So there's very very preliminary evidence. And then I did do the study that I talked about with our my OBGYN resident. We looked at stress levels using a standardized stress level questionnaire, mm-hmm. In residents at Dell Medical School, and measured their blood AMH by blood spot. And our number was small, but it did look like the ones who were highly stressed, well, actually most of everybody was stressed, but the ones that had particularly stressed seemed to trend towards a decrease in AMH. But it's really early, but I think definitely, you know, there is literature to suggest that maybe there is an association, but I think it's still too early to say, but I would love to continue to do that study.
Oh, how interesting. It is also something that we could work with our residents to keep their stress levels low, especially when they're planning to have a family. So, many times residents talk about freezing eggs and what is the process like, and what age would they want to start freezing eggs? Can you educate us on that, please?
Sure. So the key is the younger that you are, the better success rates you have with egg freezing. So the process is really basically very similar to what women go through for IVF. But apart from, instead of fertilizing the eggs, we just freeze them at the end. So the process is really, every month a woman ovulates one egg. And in egg freezing or even IVF, what we're trying to do is rescue those follicles that weren't meant to be that month. And so they'll be doing injectable medication called FSH to rescue those other follicles that weren't meant to be. So we're trying to get more follicles to grow, which contain the oocytes. Mm-hmm. And then this is a process like of injections for about 9 to 10 days. And then at the end of the injections, then you have the egg retrieval. So the egg retrieval happens in the sort of outpatient. They get propofol, so they're under sedation. They should not feel any pain. And basically, as I tell my patients, we basically put a needle through your vagina and poke your ovaries and suck up the eggs. So that's an egg retrieval. And then the embryologist will look at the eggs, and they will strip the granulosa cells from the oocytes to see which ones are mature. And only the mature eggs can be frozen.
Okay. Wow, that's quite a process. But how commonly is this done?
So a few years back, ASRM, the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, had deemed egg freezing no longer experimental. So I would say that definitely in the last few years, there has been a sort of significant increase in number of women wanting to do egg freezing because it's no longer experimental. So I think it's definitely on the rise.
Okay.
So a couple of questions to follow up. One would be cost. One would be, is this covered by insurance? And finally, are there any contraindications? Are there women that should not have this procedure done?
Sure. So cost-wise, it depends on where you go. You know, it could range from $7,000 to $10,000. Obviously, the private practice will be more on the more expensive side. So this is basically covers the ultrasounds, the blood work, the egg retrieval, the freezing the eggs. The medications are never included in any of the pricing. Mm-hmm. So medications are pretty expensive and can be between $2,000 to $4,000 on top of the actual
injections for all of the 9 injections.
Right, exactly. Okay. And whether insurance covers it or not, so I know that now UT faculty and UT staff, they have Progyny, and so they have fertility coverage, and that covers egg freezing. I can't speak for the residents, but I would say that normally if you work for a tech company, they have a lot of resources, and they do have fertility coverage. So it really depends on the insurance. I would say even insurances that are covered for infertility, they may not cover egg freezing because those patients aren't infertility. So there are some nuances on whether it's covered or not.
Got it. So really we're looking at, if a resident is interested, depending on insurance, they could be looking at anywhere from $10,000 to $20,000 per episode.
I would say probably not 20. I would say more like 10 to 12,000.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
that's helpful.
And obviously, the number of eggs to achieve a live birth. I usually counsel patients and women, you should get at least 10 eggs per baby that you want. And obviously, the older the woman will need more eggs. So if we're talking about like a 37-year-old woman or 38, you may need 15 to 20 eggs rather than 10 eggs. And I would say that if you have a partner, it is more efficient to make embryos rather than just freeze your eggs, because eggs are very more difficult to freeze than embryos are, so i.e. fertilized eggs. And we've had much more experience with freezing embryos than we have been freezing eggs. So I think that there you know, women have the impression that, oh, yes, I'm going to freeze my eggs and that's my insurance policy. I would say that there's no guarantees, even with egg freezing, that you'll end up with a live birth. So I think it's an option. And, you know, if in the future that's the only thing you have in the bank, then, you know, that could be an option. But there's no guarantees that there will be a baby at the end of it, because there's been a lot of in the social media about egg freezing and people froze eggs and they don't have a baby. And so there's some sort of backlash about sort of egg freezing.
Wow, that is good to know. So much valuable information. As we work with trainees, you know, many of them go through the IVF process, and sometimes they come out with the expectation the first time around they are going to have this, you know, beautiful baby, and it doesn't work out that way. And they go through lots of ups and downs, emotions. What is the success rate, and what are some things you can educate us on that?
Sure. So in general, when I'm counseling patients, obviously depending on their infertility, but if I'm counseling a young woman under age 35, doing IVF, I would tell them they have a 40 to 50% chance of having a live birth. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the older the woman, the lower the chances. So if I'm thinking of a woman who's like 38, 39, I'm talking more like a 20 to 25% chance. So definitely age plays a huge factor in success rates. And obviously the type of infertility they have may be sort of have effect on their success as well. For instance, if there's a severe male factor, that may decrease success rates, because we're trying to get embryo the oocytes to be fertilized. The sperm is important to make embryos. So if the sperm has poor quality, then there may be difficulty getting an embryo. So that will decrease. Yeah. So I think in general, I would say 40 to 50% on likelihood of a live birth if you're under 35 years old.
Okay. So as a follow-up question, so they can go back for a second round?
Yes. So hopefully, if they have several embryos generated, mm-hmm. they can have them frozen. Okay. And so later on, if they don't get pregnant with the first baby, with the first transfer, they can come back to the frozen embryos and have a frozen embryo transfer.
Okay, yeah, that's very valuable information.
Are there any contraindications? Are there any residents or fellows, perhaps, who would not be able to go through this process?
Sure. So absolute contraindications, I would say, you know, someone who's actually got cancer, like actively, mm-hmm. obviously that's contraindications. I think that if someone has an increased risk of having blood clots, that may be a relative contraindication, because we, for instance, I have a patient who has factor V Leiden heterozygote, and so we're seeking the hematologist's advice. Yes, should we do Lovenox throughout her stimulation, because she's going to be at risk? So definitely have patients on Lovenox while doing stimulation. Mm-hmm. Even patients who've had breast cancer, again, a relative sort of, obviously if this is the only way they're going to be able to have a child, we can give them medication to keep their estrogen levels lower. And this, even so, breast cancer survivors can do IVF. So there are, I think, you know, we will try to find our way to help women. So I can't think off the top of my head, like, absolute contraindication. There's no way you can do this.
From a point of how much success rate, so there are many, many cases that you will work with them to see that there's possibility of having a baby. Because many times just having a baby becomes such a big issue, and then that they go through such an emotional trauma because of that.
Yeah. So I think it's a discussion with the patient. Here's your risks, and here are, you know, what you know, where we're at, sort of balancing the risks and the benefits. And it really, you know, we can support the patients through, or women through their journey as best we can. And they have to decide, you know, is this too high risk for us to go through this from a medical point of view if they have other medical issues. So I think it's a dialogue. I don't think we can say, oh, well, you have this. We say, oh, no, you can't do that. But IVF is an elective procedure, so it's not like we're treating cancer. So it's a, you know, we want it to be safe for the patient.
Sure. Yeah, sure. Sounds very encouraging, though.
So a question for you, Vina. You and Adriana being behavioral health providers, this isn't an uncommon question that you're asked by our female residents, correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We work with many residents who have this. They go through emotional process that how we are going through this process, what do we do? And we support them. And I heard you many times saying that we counsel, and in a way we counsel them through their emotional process. And any tips for that for us, how to work with them in that field?
Yeah, so I think especially female physicians, they're you know, they've gone through their life being able to achieve so much. And I think that for them, this is kind of a failure because they can't have a baby. And I think it hits them even harder.
Exactly, you're so right.
So I think really it's great that you provide that. And I really think that patients in general should have that emotional like support because it is tough. And, you know, the amount of female physicians I've seen who we're trying to balance, like, when do we get your ultrasounds in between your clinics? And so it's even more logistically hard for female physicians to like balance all, especially residents, like, mm-hmm. When are we going to see them for their ultrasound in their IVF cycle? Because we have other women in other careers who are barely able to juggle just, you know, going through, you know, just one job and that's less intense. So I think, you know, having, the, you know, you, Vina, and your team is I think, crucial to their journey. Just to support them and say, hey, all these, you know, all your feelings about feeling as a failure, you know, lots of people go through that. In your case, it's not that you're a failure. It's just, you know, you have the hormones and that, you know, you have ups and downs and, you know, just try your best.
That is such a valuable information. And thank you for bringing this up. And it is true. Both Adriana and I work with many and then we support them through the process. Whatever it is, we are there for them. And yeah,
and hopefully decreasing some of their stress yes. level, which exactly. we heard yeah, exactly. is certainly a factor in
That's
this.
That's right.
So one more question, Winnie. How can partners, their partners help in this process, this IVF process, besides obviously
sure.
what we've already discussed?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's always great to see when you see patients together as a couple, and I get more concerned when it's just the female and not the male. So definitely I think the partner is a huge important part of this, apart from providing the sperm, because I think it is an emotional roller coaster for women in general, and if they have a very supportive partner, it makes it, you know, easier,
yeah.
relatively speaking, for them, that they have someone else who can go through that with them and who they can share those sad moments or happy moments with, who, because they're going through it together. I think for men, obviously, you know, I take care of patients where my special interest is recurrent miscarriage. Mm-hmm. So definitely the in those couples, the men are also very affected. And we sort of think less about, you know, in infertility, because many times we don't see the partner, so there's not much dialogue. But mm-hmm. I think definitely if there's a partner involved, I always try to get them involved and explain the procedure, what their wife is going to go or partner is going to go through, because it is a lot for the women to go through. And it's important that their spouse or partner understands what their partner is going through, and that they will have these emotional ups and downs, and that's normal. So I think it's really important to have a supportive spouse or partner.
Given those emotional ups and downs that you're talking about, If a resident or a woman in general is going through this process, especially during those injections and all, Do you recommend that they take a leave? Do you recommend that they may take or try to do this on a week of vacation where that's their sole focus and not having to deal with the stresses of the operating room or the clinic or the wards?
I think if possible, yes. but vacation is precious, so yes. They may not want to take time off. But I think definitely because they'll have to come to the clinic at least 3 or 4 times for ultrasounds, and we try to see patients first thing in the morning, at 7:30 till like 9 o'clock. But sometimes clinics run over, and so if you have to be at rounds, it's going to be difficult mm-hmm. to get to your ultrasound yes. appointment. So logistically, that adds an additional stressor onto you, yes. like, oh, how am I going to get to the ultrasound? And, what if I have to go into the clinic tomorrow? Or, because the egg retrieval, usually we have a couple of days ahead notice, but it could be any time in like a week. And, you only have 2 days notice. Oh, I have to go and have my egg retrieval. So that yeah. obviously then you're like, oh, who am I going to get to cover, my clinic or my shift? And so that's a lot more additional stressor that if you could have that week off, or 10 days, that would, I think, be highly helpful.
Yeah. Winnie, the other thing you were talking about, recurrent loss
yes.
And partners. So, in fact, me and Adriana have supported some through recurrent loss and what partners go through because they feel helpless. They don't know what mm-hmm. to do. And they feel like they're just watching.
Right.
So we support them. Just being there for them mm-hmm. is also very helpful.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, this has been wonderful information, Winnie. I've certainly learned a lot that I didn't know just in this last 30 minutes. We really hope that our residents and fellows can make some informed decisions and be at peace with this process. If someone is interested in following up or getting more information, is there a way that they could contact you or your group to get more information?
Yeah, so I think our email is on the you can find us on the faculty sort of email. Definitely you can come and see us at the MOC. And if you want sort of resources sort of to talk about egg freezing, so you can go to the American Society of Reproductive Medicine or ASRM mm-hmm. and they have patient resources, really simple, like click on the patient resources and there'll be like egg freezing sheet and it'll tell you all about egg freezing. So I think I would suggest that to anybody who wants to have more evidence-based rather than sort of the blogs out there.
Sure.
Yeah. Winnie, we ask all our guests to leave us with a pebble. Mm-hmm. That can be a tip. That can be something residents can take with them after listening to your podcast. So what is your pebble for us today?
Sure. So I would tell all women out there, there's never a right time to have a baby, but start early, and then hopefully you'll never have to see me.
Yeah, very good tip indeed. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a very valuable time for us, and we have learned a lot from you.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and I'm happy to, if any resident or fellow would want to reach out, happy to talk more.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ripple's Physicians Wellbeing is made possible by the Joe R. and Teresa Lozano Long School of Medicine Office for Graduate Medical Education. To contact us or learn more about the Wellness Home, visit gmewellness.utesca.edu.
This podcast is inspired by the Dalai Lama's powerful quote, "Just as ripples spread out when a single pebble is dropped into water, the actions of individuals can have far-reaching effects." We provide physicians with pebbles, tangible and actionable practices that can help make positive impacts in their personal and professional lives.